From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And workplace violence consultants are hearing from companies today after yesterday's shooting of two journalists, allegedly by a former colleague who later killed himself.
He had a history of conflicts, according to WDBJ's general manager, who said he was fired in 2013 because some employees felt threatened and was escorted out of the building by local police when he didn't take it well. CNN Money titled its report today, "The shooting homicide in Virginia is a tragic reminder that workplace violence is real." Well, how real? Joel Dvoskin is a psychologist with the Threat Assessment Group. They teach workplace violence prevention. So, Joel, how real is it?
Well, of course, it depends on how you define violence. So homicides in the workplace are actually very, very rare, and they've gone down in recent years. So if you think of the millions of workers and workplaces in the United States, there's about 500 workplace homicides a year, and that number is reasonably stable, and it used to be about 1,000, so it's gone down.
Huh.
If you look at minor types of violence, they are very, very common. If you look at bullying or sexual harassment, verbal abuse or minor kinds of violence, intimidation and threats, they're an everyday occurrence in American workplaces, unfortunately.
Well, I'm sure. Are you hearing from workplaces today? You know, this has been chilling. And in addition to the, you know, the grief for the people involved, have you been hearing from workplaces suddenly thinking, well, wait a second, what about that guy we fired? Or how do we know when this is going to escalate?
Yes. We always get more calls after a highly publicized event like this.
And what are people's concerns?
Well, the concerns are range from this guy's been scaring his coworkers for months or even years, and should we do something about it, to more imminent crises where someone has actually made a serious threat of violence. Many of our companies we work with on a regular basis, and they're very well trained in how to prevent and respond to threats of violence.
Well, so what should a company do? Here you had a company, meaning the TV station, that assessed that there was a problem and fired someone. So there are people asking, well, wait, after that happens, if somebody is angry enough that they have to be escorted out of the building with police, is there a process to maybe follow them or track them? Or does that violate people's rights? I mean, what does a company do?
Well, the most important question is what companies should do before, not what they should do after. So early is good and late is bad. And I actually make audiences chant that because it's so important. I want them to remember it. The earlier you intervene, the more options that you have. The second point I would make is that what has been called warning signs or profiles, there certainly are some consistencies that people have who do this, but they are so common that they're worthless for prediction. So you can train people to look for signs of a troubled person, but you have to understand that the vast majority of troubled people will never hurt anybody. In fact, they're more likely to hurt themselves than anybody else. People who do this are typically angry, and they're often depressed. They often feel insignificant. These are acts of suicide. They almost always die or end up locked up for the rest of their lives. Just one fact that surprises people. There were 11,000 gun homicides in the United States last year. There were 19,000 gun suicides. So if we prevent suicides, which we know how to do, we're going to prevent some of these events. We'll just never know what we prevented. And part of that is just having good community mental health responses to people in crisis.
Yeah.
And our community mental health system has been decimated by budget cuts over the last 20 years.
Well, and I'm reading an interesting statistic that underscores some of the things you're saying. Workplace violence is many times not about work at all. And 2/3 of workplace homicides, the assailant doesn't even know the victims.
Yeah, I mean, people bring all of the problems that they have in life with them to work. And again, the point is that people who are in despair and have no hope for ending their pain often will decide that suicide is the only way to end their pain. And if they're angry enough, they may decide, a small percentage of them will decide to take others with them.
Joel Dvoskin, again, forensics and clinical psychologist with the Threat Assessment Group. They teach workplace violence prevention. Joel, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you guys for trying to get these stories right. I really appreciate NPR very much.
Well, in the world of politics, we've been hearing a lot of buzz about Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, the socialist senator from Vermont. In the UK, they've got their own Bernie Sanders, you could say, a socialist named Jeremy Corbyn, who could be the next leader of the Labour Party. BBC political correspondent Ross Hawkins joins us from London. And Ross, tell us, who is Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, for years, the politics of the Labour Party, the party on the left of British politics, has been in more or less the place that Tony Blair put it. He managed to turn the Labour Party from somewhere on the left that proposed, for example, getting rid of all nuclear weapons unilaterally, that proposed taking major industries back into the possession of the state once more, into something far more in the centre ground. And he won big in British politics. And most people assume that one way or another, a large part of that debate was done until the last few weeks, when this man called Jeremy Corbyn, he's been around for years and years in the British Parliament, House of Commons, since 1983. He only just squeaked onto the ballot paper. Some of the MPs who nominated him to get him there only did so because they say, we need to have a debate with this guy. He was expected to come a sorry last place. And yet, he appears, from the limited data and the limited polling that we have, to be the runaway favourite. And I can tell you for absolute certain, there are plenty of senior people in the Labour Party who are now taking his victory, a decision that will be made when they count the votes on September the 12th, as a given. And if that is the case, British politics could change pretty radically.
Well, and he's been talking about some of the things that you just mentioned there. Let's listen to him here speaking with your BBC colleague, Andrew Marr, talking about how he wants to change the direction of the Labour Party.
It's been too close to big business. It's been too close to economic orthodoxy. It's been incapable of offering Labour voters and the majority of the electorate a real alternative. And that was the fundamental problem in the last general election.
So sounds pretty reasonable, that argument. On the other hand, we see that he's created some controversy this week by saying that he would consider women-only train cars to stop the rise in assaults on public transport in London. So is he fringe or is he how would you describe him?
Oh, plenty of people in British politics would have and still do describe him as a fringe candidate, someone whom, if he was sitting in a tea room over in the House of Commons over the road from where I speak to you, would be surrounded by a relatively small group of people, all of whom would be presumed to be pretty marginal. What is remarkable is that when he suggests the policy, and it was only a suggestion that he made today, that he would listen to the arguments for women-only train cars, the idea being that that could deal with sexual harassment, is that it becomes headline news here. This is a man who's talked about ideas for years and years and years and gone ignored. There are three other candidates in this race and none of them seem to be able to get the traction. The other extraordinary thing that has happened and that could change the Labour Party forever, whether he wins or not, is hundreds of thousands of people have come to the Labour Party as new members or registered supporters, potentially changing the face of its politics. And huge controversy here. His opponents say what's happened is you've got all sorts of people on the left of British politics who might have been involved in other parties further the left trying to get involved. They say people hostile to the Labour Party, conservatives, the right-wing party here, who wish it ill, are getting involved that way. But while those rows rage on, he just goes around the country. And I was at one of his meetings where hundreds and hundreds of people turn out. It's not unique, but in Britain, for 600-700 people to turn out for a political meeting, and not because they were bussed in by a bunch of spin doctors ahead of time, that's pretty unusual.
Well, and a lot of people comparing Jeremy Corbyn to Bernie Sanders in this country, who is a socialist senator from Vermont, who's getting huge crowds at his rallies seeking the Democratic nomination for president. But is Jeremy Corbyn where the country is? If he were ever to get to the point where he was, you know, one of the candidates to become the next prime minister, which won't be for several years now, but if that happened, is he where the country is?
That is the crucial question. He makes those international comparisons too. He says there's a movement that you talk about there in the US. There's a movement we've seen with Syriza in southern Europe. He thinks he's part of that movement. His people, and he argue, there are a whole bunch of young people who didn't vote before. There are a whole bunch of older people who mistrust politics and that he can draw them in. But, and it's a huge but, a huge number of people in the Labour Party think that if he wins, the Labour Party may feel very good about itself in parts for days, maybe the protest movement it always dreamt of, and then when it comes to an election, they'll be humiliated and crushed to bits by the Tories. That is the case, but by his critics, what is perhaps surprising, that seems something that seems so obvious, so self-evident to those on the right of the Labour Party, has had absolutely no traction whatsoever with what appear to be huge numbers of supporters of Jeremy Corbyn's.
The BBC's political correspondent Ross Hawkins speaking with us from London. Ross, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Is New Orleans safe 10 years after Hurricane Katrina killed almost 2,000 people and devastated the Gulf Coast? Our next guest says the real question is, can New Orleans even continue to exist? And he says the answer depends on three things. One is flood protection. Now, we know that New Orleans levees were said to be able to protect against 100-year storms. People think that's a once-in-a-lifetime storm. It isn't. It's an insurance calculation. It makes my head explode, but it really means there's actually a pretty good chance, 50%, that a storm of that size can hit in a lifetime. But the levee breaches in New Orleans weren't as much because of Katrina, but because of mistakes made by the Army Corps of Engineers. And our guest says pay attention to other concerns. There's a master plan to prevent the loss of land that acts as a buffer in New Orleans, but will there be the political will to pay for it? John Barry is author of Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi River Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America. He's also a former member of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East. More on the former part in a moment. And he joins us from New Orleans. So, John, start with the city's new flood protection system. You say it is robust enough to protect against the so-called 100-year storm, and that's okay.
Well, I think it is a quote, robust, the word engineers tend to use, a robust system for 100-year protection. The way you would improve the standard is not to, so much to build the levees higher. In fact, the levees right now are basically high enough to protect against a 500-year storm, Stillwater storm surge. In other words, if it were just the height of a 500-year storm and you take the waves off the top of that storm, then we actually would have 500-year protection right now. Hmm. And the way you take the waves off the top of a storm is have that storm travel over land. As that happens, then the waves dissipate. Probably anybody who's paid attention to this issue at all knows that Louisiana has lost roughly 2,000 square miles of coast. That's equivalent to Delaware. If you put Delaware between New Orleans and the sea, you wouldn't need any levees at all.
You just made one example of the land loss in this area, you know, the size of Delaware. You say it's land loss that would dissolve Manhattan in 18 months if
That's
nothing
correct.
Is
That's
done.
That's a rated, yeah. Right. That's yeah. a rated. It's still dissolving into the ocean.
That's amazing. So you say if nothing's done, it could, you know, pretty much disappear. And this is – it's the land that takes the top off the – storm surge that's so important to protect the city. So what's being done on that level, the land loss level?
There is a state master plan. It wouldn't solve the problem, but it would address the problem in a reasonable way that would give New Orleans and the rest of the coast a chance to survive. There is probably enough sediment left in the Mississippi River to rebuild enough land to provide buffers against storm surge. The sediment has declined. The natural load of the river is at least 30% less, maybe 50% less. A lot of that is sitting behind dams on the Upper Missouri River. But there's probably enough sediment. Studies suggest that there is enough sediment to do what needs to be done. The question then is the political problem.
So let's go to the political problem, because as you write, a huge percentage of the land loss in the area is because of dredging by oil, gas, and pipeline companies, an estimated 10,000 miles of canals through the coast. Kills plants, you know, when their roots die, land dissolves because the land was held onto by the roots. So tie that to politics.
Okay, well, first, I don't want to blame all the land loss on the oil and gas industry. That is not the case. There are multiple causes, certainly including the levees themselves, which prevent the river from flooding and naturally sustaining the land. But there is no question that the oil and gas industry is a major contributor to land loss. Their own studies of the area where the land loss has been most severe in this state say, quote, the overwhelming cause, unquote, is oil and gas operations. You know, they have liability. Since 1980, the state has required them to, quote, restore to the pre-existing condition, unquote. They've done very little. And there's a great reluctance in Louisiana to ask them to pay their share.
Well, this is why the board you were once a part of, the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East, which was created after Katrina, sued 97 oil companies. And the hope was that the lawsuit would precipitate a statewide settlement. It would fund the master plan to try to protect New Orleans and bring back the sediment. And it would fund it through more litigation or taxes on the industry. You say Governor Bobby Jindal tried to gut the board, replaced a flood expert with a lobbyist who's the treasurer of Jindal's wife's foundation. And in fact, were you not reappointed to the board because of your backing of the lawsuit?
That's correct. I was more or less the architect of the lawsuit, so I was target number one. This was a board of people who were very capable of reviewing what the Corps of Engineers did and correcting it if they were making a mistake. And also, the board was capable of coming up with its own ideas to protect the city. And the only way we could fulfill that was if we had some money. That is why we sued the oil companies. But as a general statement, the business and political establishment in Louisiana reacted in astonishment and outrage that we had the temerity to tell the truth. And I don't think the master plan is a good plan, but officially, the number is $50 billion. Reality is it's more like, according to a Tulane University study of the actual costs, it's more likely to be $95 to $115 billion. And essentially, the only money the state has is what's coming. I'm oversimplifying, but the money that's coming from the BP settlement, which will be $6.5 to $9 billion that will actually make it down to repairing the coast.
Way short of what's needed.
Rather.
So, John Barry, what do you conclude? I mean, you write that, you know, New Orleans is looking at its 300th anniversary in 2018. You say if politics blocks action, the 300th anniversary will most likely be the last centennial that the city celebrates. Do you think New Orleans can survive?
Well, there is a question of luck involved. You know, you could go 1,000 years without a 100-year storm hitting you, or you could get 5 in 10 years. It's totally random. If we were lucky and avoided a major storm, then you certainly survive. But you have to stop that land loss. And again, that can't happen without money. I do believe the federal government does have a responsibility. A lot of the, as I said earlier, the industry is not the sole cause of land loss. One of the main causes is the shipping industry, which is international. That benefits the entire country, yet Louisiana bears 100% of the costs. The Gulf Intracoastal Waterway runs from Texas to Florida. That benefits those areas more than it benefits Louisiana, although it certainly does benefit Louisiana. Another reason why I think the entire country should share in the cost, dams on the upper Missouri River retain tremendous amounts of sediment, over 100 million tons a year, that used to come down the river and would have made it much easier if we still had that sediment to rebuild the coast. So there are many reasons why the entire nation should share in the cost. But so should the oil industry, which has very direct liability. You know, they caused it. Their own studies say they caused land loss, and I would expect the industry to meet its legal and moral obligations.
You have one last cautionary thought in an article you wrote in the New York Times. Can you recall the T.S. Eliot line?
Waiting, watching, and waiting. anybody who pays any attention to poetry, I mean, T.S. Eliot's, you know, certainly one of America's greatest poets, starts out saying, I do not know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god. Eliot grew up in St. Louis. And goes on to say that people in cities tend to forget about the water is there waiting, watching and waiting.
John Barry, author of Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi River Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America, commenting on Katrina and how it's changed New Orleans. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The college football season doesn't kick off until next week, but already several coaches are on the hot seat. USC coach Steve Sarkisian for making a drunken speech at a USC rally. Rutgers coach Kyle Flood for allegedly contacting a faculty member about a player who was in danger of being ruled academically ineligible. And Art Briles, coach at Baylor, under fire because he accepted a transfer who had a violent past. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com, and as far as we know, is not in any trouble so far this year. Mike, right, as a coach?
I keep having that academic probation dream, but yeah, okay. That paper I never handed in.
Well, let's start with the drunken speech by Steve Sarkisian.
Well, he says not so much drunken as a mixture of alcohol and medication, and that's why he changed his words, and now alcohol has been banned from the coaches' quarters of the team's facility. I do think that this, just this alone, we could take his explanation at face value. It's just that USC has, in the recent past, really had some strange stories associated with it. The coach before Sarkisian, Lane Kiffin, was just a nightmare in so many ways, and then last year there was that strange story about the player who claimed to have hurt himself jumping off a balcony to save his nephew from drowning. Real story, he was scaling down an apartment after being in an altercation with his girlfriend. So I think of all the things we're going to talk about, this is more in the category of, I hope it's more in the category of strange and not necessarily very concerning.
And yeah, it doesn't seem as concerning as the other two. And let's go to Rutgers and what we know about this allegation against Coach Kyle Flood.
Yeah. So this was, again, this is not life and death, but it does seem, I mean, it has been shown that Kyle Flood likely contacted a professor who has been revealed to be a $5,000 a year adjunct. Kyle Flood makes $1 million, I think $779,000, actually. And coaches aren't supposed to, not just by ethics, but by letter of the law, be contacting teachers to talk about grades. That's all supposed to go through academic advisors. So Flood gave an explanation that he contacted this teacher because he was so concerned about the student, but it does at least raise issues of putting pressure on the academic departments in service of the football team. And I do got to say, what's going on with Rutgers, there's just so many growing pains around this school that's never, well, in the last 60 years, has been a football powerhouse. They joined the Big Ten. They have a huge stadium. And so they are, let's say, a middlingly successful mid-sized school trying to compete in the biggest division. And we're going to see stories like this whenever that happens.
And then you've got this story at Baylor with the school accepting a player who transferred from Boise State and then being convicted of sexually assaulting a woman who played for Baylor's soccer team. But when you put all these together, Mike, what does this tell you? Just that you can get away with anything in college football because you make so much money?
Well, that last story, Art Briles, the coach of Baylor, just unbelievably disturbing. This player, I mean, forget football. Should he have been allowed on the football team? I don't understand why Sam Owachu would even be allowed on the Baylor campus with a violent history. Then you have a back and forth between his current coach and his old coach, who told what to who. But I think the bigger story is a player being able to get away with sexual violence and violence. And just because he's good at football, being allowed on teams, he's now serving jail time.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. The changing world, or maybe not, of college football, but weigh in at hereandnow.org. Mike, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We've been reporting this week on a new PDK Gallup survey on testing in schools that finds almost two-thirds of respondents think there is too much emphasis on standardized testing, compared with just 7% who think there's too little. So what's going on? Why such a backlash against testing? Josh Starr is the CEO of Phi Delta Kappa International, which sponsored the Gallup poll. He's also the former superintendent of schools in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Stamford, Connecticut. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Jeremy. It's
well,
great to be here.
What stuck out to you in these numbers?
Well, clearly, Parents these days feel there's too much emphasis on testing. It's clear that they want to see schools focus on teacher quality. They want to see schools focus on curriculum. You know, who's teaching my kid and what are they teaching? Although there are some differences between different demographic groups, and I think it's really important to understand that. But I think the age of over-relying on standardized tests is starting to wane.
Well, tell us about the demographic information. It is interesting. And one of the things is that among Blacks and Latinos, the amount of people who think that testing is not the way to go or that there's too much testing is lower than it is among whites.
Yeah, I mean, the data show clearly, and I encourage people to go to our website to really look at the data. Blacks and Hispanics, particularly Blacks, tend to place more value on the results of standardized tests. They prefer it for comparisons to other districts within neighboring districts within their state or whatever it may be. So I think there's some serious considerations that policymakers and leaders have to make when they're looking at the makeup of their community and the role that tests should play going forward in national and local education policy.
Do you have any sense of why that is, why there's that demographic difference?
You know, clearly, there's been an achievement gap in this country for a long, long time. And African-Americans and Latinos want to know that their kids are being held to the same standard as white kids. And the tests will tell you that. You know, since No Child Left Behind was passed 15 years ago, the test scores have shown what we've always known but have not been able to prove in the same way. There are significant differences in achievement between different groups of kids, and there's differences in funding and resourcing. The test scores show that, and I would imagine that folks who are advocating for more resources, better funding, et cetera, want to continue to have those scores present and available to be able to continue to make their case.
And yet so many people in this survey just think we're doing way too much testing, too much focus
That's
on
right.
teaching to the test. Why is that? There are going to be some people who hear this conversation and think that the reason is because it's gotten so political. Things like the Common Core, they're hearing messages from politicians about how bad the tests are. But is it about that or is it about personal experience?
So I think it's a combination of a couple of things. You know, the tests themselves, many of them are not so bad. Frankly, a lot of them have gotten better. But there's a combination of a couple of factors. One, that there is just too much testing. You know, kids have to take too many tests too often. But the other is the policies associated with it. So people really don't want to see teachers evaluated by standardized tests. I was talking to my own kids about that last night, my middle schoolers, and they said, yeah, well, why should they be? Because if a kid, you know, blows off class, well, why should the teacher be accountable for that? But at the policy level, we've really started to use test scores in some very inappropriate ways that don't match up with science. Anybody who's designed a test, as well as the so psychometricians and test companies themselves, will tell you that the tests aren't being used for the purpose that they were designed. And I think people are starting to feel that and realize that and want to see a change.
So what does that mean for the Common Core, which has been adopted by more than 40 states now, this set of standards?
So I think folks have convoluted the Common Core standards, which are simply a set of standards, with the testing and the policy regime of the last few years. The Common Core state standards don't say anything about how often kids should be tested. The Common Core state standards don't say anything about how those scores should be used for teacher evaluations or designations of school improvement or anything else. They simply are a set of standards that say what kids should know and be able to do. And in fact, our polling data shows that parents want to see higher standards. But they also, our data also show that folks are not that supportive of the Common Core. So I think what's happened is the testing and the overemphasis on testing and the linking of policies that don't work and are, in fact, hurting schools has been linked to the Common Core, but they are, in fact, two separate and distinct things.
That's Josh Starr, the CEO of Phi Delta Kappa International, which sponsored the Gallup survey. And he's also the former superintendent of schools in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Stamford, Connecticut. Josh, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So what are the implications of these changing attitudes? We're joined now by Andy Smerick. He's a partner at Bellwether Education Partners and a member of the Maryland State Board of Education. He's also the former Deputy Commissioner of Education in New Jersey. Andy, where would we be without standardized testing in school?
We would be much further behind when it comes to the progress we've made had it not been for testing. We have identified the achievement gap. We've been able to implement interventions to help students, especially low-performing students. And we've given taxpayers and policymakers more information than they've ever had before on the effectiveness of our schools. So testing certainly has virtues.
Do you think that testing is a good way, though, to evaluate teachers, individual teachers, to base their pay, to base their employment on how well their students are doing on these tests?
It can help. It certainly should never be the only metric that is used. So in the past 5, 6, 7 years, the method that's been that most states have used is called multiple measures. You use observations of teachers. You use different measures of student progress. And one of those measures could be how much progress from the beginning of the year to the end of the year did a teacher's students make. That can help inform whether or not the educator is doing a great job in making sure their students are learning what they need to learn. It's by no means the definitive or the only measure that we should use, but it can be helpful.
But the critics would say that teacher, in trying to improve how well students do on the test, is just going to focus on the test, is going to teach to the test and not focus on some other things that they could be teaching their students that might be more important.
Well, that's right. And this is one of the most important critiques that antagonists of tests use. And I think it's true. It has a lot of validity. That is, if testing is used in the wrong ways, it can distort what happens in the classroom. If we use test results as the only indicator in a teacher's evaluation, it's going to totally change what a teacher does. But that does not mean that we should totally get rid of tests. We need to make sure that they are in their proper place and that they are one of many ways that we assess if a school is doing its job, if a classroom is learning enough, if an educator is effective. So what I always like to say is we should concede that testing may have gone too far, but that doesn't mean that we should overcorrect and totally go back on all the progress we've made over 30, 35, 40 years on getting information from tests.
Do you think that's a possibility right now that even one state will decide we're not going to do tests anymore?
Well, it will be difficult if for no other reason than if they want Title I money, the billions and billions of dollars from the federal government. It's certainly required underneath of the current version of the major federal law, the No Child Left Behind Act, that they have to do reading and math tests, at least in some grades. So effectively, a state would have to say, we want no federal money if they simultaneously decide that they don't want to do any kinds of tests. And I think most states are of the mind that we need to be moderate in our use of assessments, but we don't need to totally get rid of all of them. I haven't seen any state go in that direction yet.
And you don't expect Congress to come in and, with this backlash against the test, decide to not tie Title I money to the taking of standardized tests?
Well, it's been interesting. Maybe call it 9 months ago, 12 months ago, there was some thought that Congress could totally end the use of testing as a requirement of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And largely, it's been because there have been a whole lot of civil rights organizations, groups that are deeply concerned about the achievement gap, and other types of organizations that have said, yes, let's make sure that we don't overuse tests, but if we get rid of tests, make sure you realize that that means that we're going to have less information about the performance of our most disadvantaged kids, that we're not going to have information on how all of our districts are doing compared to one another. So there is absolutely a cost to getting rid of assessments and the results they give us.
That's Andy Smarek of Bellwether Education Partners. He's a member of the Maryland State Board of Education and author of the book, The Urban School System of the Future. Andy, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been hearing this summer about abortion opponents targeting Planned Parenthood with undercover sting videos. Another was released this week. But ProPublica reports on how anti-abortion activists are increasingly going after the personal health records of patients at clinics that offer abortions, including Planned Parenthood, filing public record requests with states, and sifting through garbage bins. Charles Ornstein is a senior reporter for ProPublica. Charlie, you describe this as a quiet evolution in the fight over abortion, an unofficial playbook of sorts. So what are these activists doing?
Well, I think that they are trying to use all means at their disposal to discourage abortion. And so what I saw was being very aggressive in terms of requesting 911 calls whenever an ambulance comes to an abortion facility, requesting autopsy reports if somebody dies, and then also looking at trash cans and dumpsters that are on clinic property, going in there, looking for records that have been discarded, and then filing complaints based on that to say that clinics aren't protecting patient privacy.
And so in other words, they're finding records in the garbage that should not be there because of privacy concerns, and then accusing the clinic of violating the patient's privacy.
Well, even that is under debate, as everything is in when you're talking about abortion. When I spoke to folks that are affiliated with abortion clinics, they said that, in fact, many of these garbage bins are on private property, and so abortion opponents are trespassing. In one case, I talked to an owner in Kansas City who said that he later learned that the dumpster on his property had been locked by a common key that was used by the dumpster company. So somebody had gotten in contact with a key like that and then opened the lock, he contended. He filed trespassing charges. Nothing came of it. But, you know, these battles are being played out in state after state all across the country, and they're much more quiet than the ones you see that involve legislation or these Planned Parenthood videos.
Well, why? You just described that the garbage search was more about trying to accuse clinics of not respecting a patient's privacy. But why would they take pictures of ambulances or sue to get records of what's happening at the clinic?
So let's take a case out of Indiana where Indiana Right to Life filed a request that was granted with the state health department. They asked for copies of termination of pregnancy reports, which are the reports that clinics have to file with the state as a matter of vital record tracking. They used those reports to analyze them and look for clinics that were not reporting abortions within the time frame that was set out by state law. In one case, it involved minors, which the state law required that abortions involving minors had to be reported within 3 days. So four doctors currently face discipline against their medical licenses, and one doctor faces a criminal charge as a result of the complaints filed by Indiana Right to Life. So that's an example which they would say shows that doctors aren't following the law. I think what you find folks who support abortion rights say is that this is simply intimidation, that anti-abortion activists will stop at nothing to discourage women, to intimidate women, to scare women away from getting abortions, and that this is a very real threat to reproductive rights across the country.
Well, you report that some of these activists are revealing the names of the patients when an abortion has complications.
Right. So the anti-abortion groups I've talked to, including Operation Rescue, say they don't have an interest in identifying women who have abortions, even if they have complications. But they say they very much have an interest in identifying women who die, even if the women's families don't want them identified. So this was the case when a woman went to an abortion clinic in Germantown, Maryland, and died. She was a kindergarten teacher in New York, and her name was then revealed on anti-abortion websites across the country. Her picture was taken from social media sites. Even her baby registry was reprinted
online.
Well, wait,
how did activists get that information?
So they say that they have confidential informants. And what folks who are affiliated with the abortion clinic say is clearly a medical provider at the hospital where she ultimately went had to have leaked this information. And I believe that they even filed a complaint with the hospital, and that was a violation of federal law, which prohibits the sharing of just this type of information. But it's hard to know who did it, and it's hard to know if any consequences were brought to bear.
Well, you say this is part of why groups like Operation Rescue are suing things like St. Louis's fire department for 911 call logs, again, to try to get the recordings from a Planned Parenthood clinic to see when there have been complications and someone's been called in. What do you think happens going forward? How do you see this playing out?
I think this is going to continue to play out. And I think one of the things that I've heard since we published our first story is that some people within the abortion rights community didn't realize the extent this was going on across the country, in large part because these individual lawsuits just aren't getting coverage. But it's happening all across the country. And I think that it could well emerge as a significant battleground, because the extent to which these records are made public will allow additional complaints, and that will further lead to additional discussions about the legality of abortion. So I see this gaining steam in the months to come.
That's Charles Ornstein, senior reporter for ProPublica. We'll link you to their writing at hereandnow.org. Charles, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.